Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, I'm Richard Ady. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm here till 10. Hope you can be too. If you're feeling really desperate about life, maybe even desperate enough to do something drastic, would you ring someone? The Lifeline type phone lines are there for that very reason. But do they work? We'll come back to that later in the show. First today, an election issue to really get your teeth into. How are your teeth, by the way? Can you afford to go to the dentist? 500,000 Australians are on waiting lists for public dental treatment, and nearly a quarter of us haven't been to the dentist for 2 years or more. Actually, that reminds me, I last went in May. I'm due again. You'd think it would be an area ripe for reform, for some bold election commitments. Well, the major parties have made some promises, which our first guest today says range from disappointing to stupid. Associate Professor Hans Zollner is the chairman of the Association for the Promotion of Oral Health, and he's with me now. Welcome to Life Matters again, Hans.
Good morning.
Let's start with the stupid policies, as you see them. What are they?
Well, look, recently Labor announced what they describe as teen dental, which is a substantial amount of money. It's a lot of money, about $510 million to be spent over 3 years helping families to pay for a checkup for teenagers. Now, at first sight, that sounds great. Mm. It's sold as an idea for prevention, and that would be fine if it actually delivered some preventive treatment, but it doesn't. All it's doing is, in fact, paying around about half the cost of a dental checkup without actually delivering any treatment. So a kid will turn up, you'll look in their mouth as a dentist, and you'll say, well, you know, I can see that there are some holes here that you could do some with some fluoride treatment. Maybe some fissure sealants would be great. Give you a scale. Unfortunately, teen dental will only cover the cost of you coming in here for me to tell you how bad your teeth have got.
About half of that cost.
About half that cost. And then a year later, you can come back under teen dental again and have the dentist tell you how much worse your teeth have got.
That's it. You can actually know quite a lot about how your teeth and your oral health is deteriorating.
Yep. Yeah. $510 million basically to do nothing. I mean, it's a very expensive way to do really nothing. And so it's really a silly proposal. I mean, when we first heard it, we thought, well, okay, by the time our team had analysed the proposal, I mean, I was getting phone calls from public health experts saying, how did they come across something so blatantly stupid? It's a silly proposal. We're disappointed with it, and we're just hoping that they improve upon it, because surely, I mean, it's so blatantly obvious that looking in a kid's mouth is not going to do anything to help them.
And teenagers, they're a critical group, aren't they, in terms of oral health?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Labor's absolutely right that amongst teenagers, there's about a fourfold increase in the amount of decay. So when you hit your teenage years, you really do need help. And you need help, but you don't need someone to tell you that your teeth are getting worse. You need someone to actually intervene and do something to constructively help you out of the problem. So that's really a blatantly silly proposal.
All right. Well, what about the government's Medicare dental scheme? What are that's only just started, hasn't it? And the ALP is actually saying, no, we won't continue it.
Yeah, no, that's something that we're very disappointed by. I mean, the government has recently changed. Dentistry was included in Medicare up to the value of around about $240 of treatment if you had some sort of chronic medical condition to which your dental disease was contributing. Now, the truth is it had almost no uptake because it wasn't enough money to deliver any treatment. The same problem that the current Labor proposal's got, of course. And Labor correctly criticised it and saying, look, it's not enough money to actually make a difference for the patients. If you can't get more than $240 worth of treatment, no one will take it up. And that's exactly what happened. Over a 3-4 year period, only about 7,000 people actually received any sort of treatment, nowhere near enough to help them out of trouble. Now, what the government's recently done, as of November the 1st, people with chronic medical disease can get over $2,000 worth of dental treatment a year covered under Medicare. Now, that has only just started as of November 1. Now, that's actually a step in the right direction. But the big problem with that is that you still have this silly barrier that, you have to have some chronic medical disease. Then you've
like
got
what would count?
Diabetes, a valvular heart disease. If you had a valve replacement, for example, you need very good oral hygiene, very good dental teeth, because you've got at risk of infective endocarditis. People with hemophilia, people who have had bone marrow transplants, people like that will benefit enormously. HIV, AIDS, hepatitis C. all those people really do need special dental help.
But we're not talking about a wide public health approach, are we?
No, we're not. What it does is it leaves everybody else out in the cold. And we have to remember that there are more than 32,000 hospitalisations every year for preventable dental infection. So 32,000. It's probably more, in truth. That was the most recent hard figure we can find. Some people are estimating up to 50,000 now, but at least 32,000 people every year end up being in hospital because their dental infections are so out of control. And some of those people are in there with life-threatening dental infection. The infection is, in fact, is now compromising an airway. They've got sepsis to the extent that it's going to kill them. They're going to die of a toothache unless they go into intensive care and have intravenous antibiotics and have surgical drainage. Now, 32,000 people every year, most of those 32,000 people would not be eligible for dental Medicare with the current restrictions. So
So this is the disappointing policy.
This is the disappointing policy. If there are people being hospitalised with dental infection who are not eligible for Medicare, then clearly there's something wrong with the Medicare policy. And so what we're saying to the government is, for goodness sake, remove this really blatantly silly restriction. It's unnecessary to have this sort of barrier to access to dental Medicare. And after all, it makes no sense. I mean, how does it make sense to have people hospitalised for infections that can be prevented, but not prevented with Medicare, with the support of Medicare?
Because it would cost a lot more to deal with the infections than actually address this at the prevention level.
Absolutely. I mean, somebody in intensive care for a couple of weeks, you're looking at a couple of $100,000 to have them there. You could, on the other hand, prevent that by giving them a filling.
But Labor's actually said we're going to get rid of this scheme and replace it with something else.
That's right. Labor said they're going to get rid of the scheme. And again, we don't understand this. The only good thing about teen dental that Labor has really said is that they're going to use this as a stepping stone to bringing dentistry into Medicare. That's great. But if that's true, why get rid of the only Medicare proposal current, which is, in fact, has got a chance of working? Now, they're saying that, well, it hasn't worked in the past. Well, in truth, it's only been going for a few days. It's only as of November 1 this year.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Associate Professor Hans Zollner, Chairman of the Association for the Promotion of Oral Health. We're talking about both the Coalition and the ALP's dental policies, such as they are. There is no getting around the issue of cost, is there? Extending Medicare to dental is going to be expensive.
It will be expensive. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I see it in terms of the commitment that a previous Labor government made back in the early 70s, what was it, 72, when Whitlam brought the whole of medicine into Medicare. He created Medicare, now, or Medibank as it was at that time. Now, at that time, I'm sure that there was enormous objection. People would have said, look, this will be fantastically expensive. How can we possibly cover the cost? How can we underwrite the cost of all private medical treatment in Australia? Now, that would have taken enormous courage. That would have taken great commitment to say, well, despite the fact that it's going to be expensive, we're going to do this not because it's cheap. We're not going to do it because it's easy. We're going to have Medicare because it's needed. And we should do the same with dentistry. Dentistry is small compared with medicine. If we could do it in 72, when there was a hell of a lot less money around, we can do it now for little dentistry.
How much of the 34-odd billion in tax cuts that essentially both sides have promised would you need to actually address this?
Well, I mean, you know, look, my guess is that if you focused upon the things that were important, and the truth is there's no really good way to get the numbers. What would dental Medicare cost? Hard to say. And it's very hard to say, in truth. But my guess is that you could probably deliver the most important services for about $1 billion a year. That would be a reasonable starting point. If you confined Medicare to prevention, to treatment of active infection, to pain control, then, in fact, the most important problems would be dealt with for a relatively modest cost. And if you directed much of that money towards treatment by therapists and hygienists working in teams with dentists, then, again, the costs are cut down. The Australian Dental Association is saying, oh, it would be too expensive, it would cost $5 billion every year. Well, I actually think that that's probably a bit inflated. If you were a bit careful about the way you implemented it, it could probably be done in a sensible and cost-effective way. Certainly cheaper than having people hospitalised.
Exactly. Now, even if you got the money, there's the issue of the dental workforce, isn't there? New training schools are promised by both sides in regional areas. Is that going to be what's needed?
Well, I mean, at first sight, it sounds great because we do have a workforce shortage, and particularly in rural areas, and people have a sense it sells very well electorally, particularly in if your local politician comes out and said, you can have your own dental school here in Wagga or in Orange or in Bathurst or now in Cairns. That sounds great to the local people because they think they're finally going to get some dental services. But there's no dental academic workforce to actually train them. And often these schools are unsupported by medical schools. These days, well, it's always been the case, in fact, that dentistry is taught in context of a medical school so that there is a proper medical base for the training of dentists, so that there's someone to do the anatomy and the physiology and the pathology and the histology and the infectious diseases, and someone to also teach them how to cope with medically complex patients, which is increasingly the challenge of dental education today. If you create new dental schools in isolated rural areas without the support of a medical school to really underpin them, and also don't have some way of getting dental academics there, it's not going to work. And at the moment, the truth is that there's not one dental faculty in Australia that has a full complement of academic staff across all areas. There's a worldwide shortage of dental academics, and in Australia, it's pretty tight.
Well, what could be done to address that?
Well, money has to be funneled into the dental schools to try and build them up. The established schools have to be built up, and any new schools that you build up, you've got to make sure that there's a medical school there as well, and you have to develop some way to make dental academia attractive for, in fact, dentists to go into. At the moment, there are just very few academics around, and the dental academics who are hanging in there are getting older and more haggard and more weary by the day. The number of hours...
You're looking all right, Hans?
Well, I'm exceptional, but my colleagues... it could imply that I'm being a bit lazy, but my colleagues are in fact exhausted. When I walk into a staff room and look around, everyone's looking a hell of a lot older and a lot more weary. And the truth is that if you're a junior academic, if you want to come in and start working, if you want to commit to an academic career, you're looking at another 3 to 4 years doing a PhD. Mm-hmm. Now that's fine. After that, you do your 3, 4, 5 years of postdoctoral training, and then you get to start perhaps at the associate lecturer to lecturer level. You will earn a salary around about half that of a new graduate. That you're teaching, after all that additional training, you're going to start off at a salary about half that of a new graduate. So very few young people are attracted into academia. And this is a worldwide problem. Something has to be done to address this, particularly for junior academics.
And you want the brightest minds going into academia.
You want the better ones. Yeah. Absolutely right.
Now, finally, Hans, before I let you go, Labor leader Kevin Rudd's actually been likened to a dentist, I'll quote, calm, competent, professional, conservative, not a warm figure, said one commentator. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, that's fine. I think there's another way in which Kevin Rudd's a bit like a dentist, because most dentists, certainly the Australian Dental Association, has objected to Medicare and dentistry, and seems that Kevin Rudd's equally uncommitted to dentistry going into Medicare fully. So I think that's another similarity. So perhaps there is some similarity there, and I just hope he becomes more like some other dentists that are around. I like to think that some dentists have got a bit of guts as well, and I'd like to see him show the courage to bring dentistry all the way into Medicare and to make real commitments to improving health and not this sort of relatively low-impact, showy stuff of teen dental.
All right, that's where we'll leave it. Hans, thank you very much for coming in today. Associate Professor Hans Zollner is at Sydney University, and he chairs the Association for the Promotion of Oral Health. I should say that actually one of the nicest people I've met in the last couple of years is a dentist. She's lovely. She's the mum of one of the kids at my son's school. Now, just while we're on the political stuff, Spotter Polly. I've got a Spotter Polly sighting here. I have been after you to get in touch with us if you see a politician seemingly not campaigning, though, of course, remember, in these controlled times, they may always be campaigning. Got here an email from Bill. He spotted Gary Nairn, member for Eden Monaro, the so-called bellwether seat, and also he's the Special Minister of State, driving out of a Queanbeyan garden centre in his four-wheel drive, towing a trailer load of wood chips. Should keep the Eden voters happy, says Bill. Could not tell whether the chips were sourced from old growth or plantation forests. And he also has a tip for ASIO in Pambula, which is also in Eden Monaro and on the far south coast of New South Wales. There is a Taliban street worth checking out. That's the tip for ASIO. ASIO, if you're listening, and we suspect you are, Taliban Street in Pambula. Now, coming up later on Life Matters, how global warming could become a security threat much more serious than terrorism. But next, crisis helplines. Do they really work?
We're listening to the unique sounds of Queensland trio called Teraka, with Tenzin Chogyal on Tibetan lute and vocals, Catherine Philp on cello, and River Patan on the soprano sax. Beautiful music on the Daily Planet this afternoon at 2:20, and tonight at 11:20, right here on ABC Radio National.
Most of us have heard of Lifeline, and indeed other telephone helplines, and the role they play in reaching out to people in trouble. Until recently, though, and this will surprise you, there's been very little research into just how good a job they do, especially when they're dealing with people who are suicidal. An international helplines conference gets underway on the Gold Coast today, where an analysis of the research to date will help guide phone counsellors into the future. Psychologist Bruce Turley is the manager of Lifeline's Living Works suicide intervention training programs. Hello, Bruce.
Good morning.
And also with us is Dawn O'Neill, the Chief Executive of Lifeline Australia. Hi, Dawn.
Good morning.
Bruce, I want to begin with you. Let's start with the research I mentioned. Why is it so important?
Well, I guess we've known for a long time that people call helplines regularly. Lifeline, for example, gets about 1,200 calls a day. But we've really wanted to get a much clearer sense from people who actually access the services what benefits they actually receive during the call and to what extent these benefits flow on for the period after the call. And it's been quite challenging because telephone counselling services are anonymous and the calls are confidential. But we were able finally, with some major research studies overseas, to get the permission of both the callers and the counsellors to try and get some sort of an external assessment of how effective it is or what sort of help you get from calling a helpline and how effective that help is dealing with crisis.
Let's talk about that. What hasn't really been clear before is whether people who are suicidal are calling helplines, and if they are, whether it's making a difference. What does the research say?
Well, we had a bit of a clue to that with some research that Lifeline did about 10 years ago, that people who called when they were at risk of suicide were in fact at quite high risk. But these studies in the United States have actually come up with very similar data with a much larger sample of people. And what they're showing quite clearly is that 50% of the suicide calls, the people actually had a clear plan for suicide. About half of them also had engaged in prior suicidal behaviour, which we know significantly increases risk. And we also found that about 8% of those callers had actually initiated some sort of suicide attempt immediately prior to the call. So by any standards, we found that we were dealing with people who were at significant risk of dying by suicide.
And if they make the call, is talking to Lifeline and other groups like yours making a difference?
Well, the studies came out with some fairly clear results on that. They looked at what was happening for people at the beginning of the call and at the end, and then 2 or 3 weeks later. And they found very clear evidence that the call actually reduced the sense of suicidal urgency that callers felt. It also made a big difference that someone had listened to the pain that was behind their call. There was less hopelessness at the end of the call, and more of a sense that perhaps positive actions that were alternative to suicide could be taken. And we did find that those effects did seem to have a flow-on benefit after the call. Nevertheless, it was also found that people 2 or 3 weeks later were still at significant risk. But 10% of those callers said that the phone that they made to the crisis line actually stopped them from taking their own life.
The studies also turned up the need to do some things better. Like what in particular?
Well, I think one of the things that came out very clearly in the studies was the issue of follow-up care and referrals. A big part of telephone counselling services is their role in linking people into further care that will help them stay safe and also deal with the underlying concerns that they have. And really, what callers told us is that they were quite disillusioned in many ways with the referral options that they had. They didn't feel that there was a wide enough range of options for them, and they also felt that when they tried to access these services, there were difficulties getting access and a sense sometimes that not all the referrals were appropriate to what they needed.
Dawn O'Neill, Chief Executive of Lifeline Australia, this is a good point to bring you in because this research will feed into training of telephone counsellors, and telephone counsellors are volunteers.
That's correct, yes. In Australia we have roughly about 4,000 trained at any one time to take calls.
You've been on a bit of a recruitment drive, in fact, haven't you?
We have. We've been running some television ads nationally and a range of other communication mediums to try to attract more people to volunteer for Lifeline.
How are you changing what you're doing as a result of what this research tells you?
We're looking at making a certain competency level, if you like, of training in how to assess risk of suicide and what to do in response, a mandatory part of the training right across the country. We, of course, do have that, but I suppose we're increasing the amount of training, looking at how we might do that, and generally improving the competency of telephone counsellors and providing more support for them across the country. We have a more intensive supervision program that we're also running to support the counsellors and help them in that process.
Because you have to, you want more people, but it is demanding, isn't it? It's full on. You need to get the right people, and they need to be very aware of what they're dealing with.
Absolutely. It's a huge commitment, and the volunteers that we have really give so much of themselves and commit a lot of time and a lot of their emotional energy into being counsellors for Lifeline.
How demanding is the telephone counselling? Because you are dealing with, Bruce mentioned a number earlier in terms of number of calls, but how many calls might you deal with on a shift, if you like?
Most shifts are around 4 hours, unless it's an evening shift, which is sometimes longer, but it's generally a 4-hour shift once a fortnight that we ask people to volunteer to do. And in that time, they may take, most calls are around 20 minutes. So it can be usually around 5 calls, generally speaking, because there's some time in between the call to write up notes and keep records and those sorts of things.
And what about this issue of referrals that Bruce mentioned and came out of the research? Volunteers needed more referral options, didn't they?
Yes, and that's one of the things that we've been trialling over the past couple of years in Australia is some follow-up programs, and there's one particular one which is a short-term crisis intervention, where basically we train a volunteer, an experienced volunteer, to buddy up, if you like, with somebody that has been assessed as being at very high risk. And they will intensively follow up that person outside of the generalist counselling service, intensively follow them up for about 6 weeks and help them connect better with supports in the community, their own networks of support, to keep them safe and alive in that period of time.
On Life Matters today, we're talking about telephone helplines, if you like, and our guests are Dawn O'Neill, who's the Chief Executive of Lifeline Australia, and Bruce Turley, Manager of Lifeline's Living Works program. We're in the internet age now, Bruce. Has that been a challenge for a telephone-based service?
Well, I think what's happened is that there's been an increasing integration of phone-based and web-based services. And in fact, Lifeline's own services is really trying to integrate those technologies quite well. So I think where we're headed in the future is that there will be a much more seamless interface between using the wider technical resources of the net and the more conventional approaches of using the telephone.
The research that we've been talking about earlier has shown that many people still get a great deal out of talking to someone on the phone, don't they?
Well, that's been a consistent finding, and even in some of the earlier research that was done, it's amazing how much benefit is derived from simply having someone who will listen with empathy and concern and care, particularly to the pain that's behind suicidal thoughts. What we know about people who are considering suicide is that there's often that sense of unbearable pain. And what the research has told us very clearly is what I think we've also found from our own experience, that providing opportunities for people to listen without being judged or criticised, to listen with understanding, to hear what's behind that pain, and to provide a supportive context in which people can feel free to talk about what's on their mind. And that in turn seems to help the whole process of being able to work together with them to look towards safe outcomes. So that's been one of the most consistent findings in counselling research, both outside of the telephone context and also on helplines, providing that baseline of opportunity to have people feel that their concerns and their pain is heard. But we do need to move beyond that to then say, well, how do we work together to try and work towards ways of keeping you safe, to take actions that start to begin to deal with some of the issues that are behind your thoughts of suicide.
Dawn, if I could come back to you. As a not-for-profit organisation, how hard is it to keep up with new technology, especially as increasingly it's not just going to be phones, it's going to be the net as well?
It's hugely challenging, and it's something we've been grappling with quite a bit. We have just finished installing a whole new phone system for Lifeline, which is a voice over IP system, which will enable callers in time, once we've worked out all of the intricacies of the policies, etc., to be able to access us via text and other technologies. Mm-hmm. But the thing that we've learned from looking at the overseas studies is that as soon as you provide access for people via those alternative text methods, the demand is huge. So for us, that's a whole other recruitment drive and a whole increase in demand for our services.
So you provide other ways of accessing your services, and instantly that demand is taken up.
Yes. That's
what happens.
Yes. It doesn't replace the demand on the phone. It's in addition to. And, of course, young people are very tech savvy. They do seem to prefer those methods of communicating. And trials that have been done in the UK and in other parts of Europe have shown that as soon as you provide access for people in those methods, they take up enormous resources.
Mm. So people, young people in particular, will text you to ask for help.
Yes, those trials have been done in the UK, and what they found was that young people, even though there's only 160 characters available for SMS, for example,
mm-hmm.
that young people will seek help. They will often talk about their suicidality and often be displaying sort of symptoms of pretty high risk.
And do you text them back, or do you try and instigate an actual phone conversation?
Initially, we text them back. I mean, that's what they've done in the UK. They've responded by text, but they try to encourage, if it is apparent that the young person is needing further help, mm. they try to encourage them to then call.
Mm. Now, just something else on this. A lot of well-known people in public life have now shared their stories of depression and life feeling like it's out of control. A good example is the former New South Wales Liberal leader John Brogdon, who did try to take his own life and has been on this show talking about it, actually. Mm-hmm. He's now got a real involvement with you, hasn't he?
Yes, he's a patron for Lifeline in New South Wales, and I have to say that I think he's been very brave and courageous in speaking about his own experiences and supporting the work that we do.
What's the value in hearing from former high flyers like him and like the former WA Premier Jeff Gallop, people like him talking out about this?
I think there is enormous value in that. I think the more that we can remove the stigma away from people, particularly men, I suppose, and so it's so important having people like Jeff and like John speaking out about their experiences, the more we can remove that stigma so that people, when they are feeling desperate, will ask for help, I think the more we will be able to assist people and help people stay well.
Hear, hear. Thank you both of you for joining me today. Well, I've been speaking to Bruce Turley, manager of Lifeline's Living Works Suicide Intervention Training Programs, and also Dawn O'Neill, who's chief executive of Lifeline Australia. And I think it's worth actually just giving the number for Lifeline again, especially if you feel like you need to talk to somebody right now. And that number is 131114 or 131114. That's the easy way to remember it, 131114. We'll also link to Lifeline's website from our own, and ours is abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. This is Life Matters with me, Richard Adie, on ABC Radio National.
Everyone knows what MGM stands for, but at Radio National, it's Movie Time Goes Mobile. If your phone connects to the internet and you want inspiration, our incisive film reviews are at your fingertips. abc.net.au/rn/mobile. And you can use your phone to rate a film with our 5-star system. Movie Time Goes Mobile. abc.net.au/rn/mobile.
Have you noticed that national security and terrorism haven't really featured in this election campaign? The more prominent threats seem to be about the hip pocket, interest rates, tax cuts. But think about the last few years. Since September the 11th, 2001, and then the Bali bombings in 2002, the threat of terrorism and how we should respond to it has really been the dominating issue. World leaders and some of our own politicians tell us that terrorism is the greatest threat we face. But is it? My next guest challenges this view. He says there are a few more important issues to worry about, so unfortunately, no time to relax. Chris Abbott is at the British Global Security Think Tank, the Oxford Research Group, and one of the co-authors of a new book, Beyond Terror. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
What are our leaders telling us about the threat of terrorism?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that it hasn't really been as much of an issue in this election in Australia as it has previously. Because up until now, really, we've been very concerned that kind of the issue of international terrorism has dominated political discourse. We're quite pleased to see that climate change has come up the political agenda here. But it'd be interesting to see whether they actually follow through on some of their promises that they make during election time.
The key thing, I think, that we've had in Australia is we haven't had a major terrorist attack on Australian soil. Quite different to you in the UK and quite different to America, of course, with September 11.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's probably played a part in the fact that it's not so much of an issue at election time this year. But then there has been numerous either attempted or foiled or actual successful terrorist attacks around the world. I mean, one of the sort of ironies of the war on terror, if you like, is that while, say, the American homeland hasn't been struck again, there hasn't been another 9/11, and people can kind of say, well, that means the war on terror has been successful. But there's actually been numerous attacks around the world, and if you count the kind of failed or prevented attacks, we're actually seeing more terrorist activity than we were before 9/11.
Okay, so there are all sorts of quotes in the book from people, from the likes of Tony Blair and George Bush and even our own John Howard, saying this is a terrible threat. It has been, academics have been at pains to say it's not an existential threat like nuclear war was for most of the second half of the 20th century. But is it the big threat? Because you clearly think that this is actually a load of old pony.
No, I wouldn't say it's a load of old pony. I mean, the interesting thing with terrorism is that it actually has massive psychological impact beyond simply the kind of loss of life and the economic effects of terrorism. And this affects our politicians as well. I mean, I don't think our politicians are involved in some grand conspiracy to convince us all that terrorism is the greatest threat. These are people at the end of the day, and they have a responsibility to protect their populations. But when you really take a hard-headed and kind of objective look at it, international terrorism just doesn't come up as the greatest threat to the world. It is still a threat, but nowhere near on the level of some of the other issues that we're discussing in the book.
Well, we'll come to those in a minute. You go as far as saying that the war on terror, as it's been called, though less so now, is actually increasing the likelihood of terrorist attacks. What's the evidence for that?
Well, you have to look at two things, really. And one of the important things is that we have to understand why young men in particular are being driven to al-Qaeda-type ideologies. And it's undoubted that it's our very policies are pushing some of these people in that direction by sort of marginalising these people, both politically and socially. They're really being pushed towards the extremes. And so we're finding that with some of the domestic policies, anyways, that come under this sort of so-called war on terror, that they're actually very much run the risk of the reverse and actually sort of driving people towards this kind of al-Qaeda-type ideology.
What specifically are you talking about in terms of domestic policy?
I mean, I'm not too sure how it is in Australia, but certainly in the UK, there is a kind of feeling that a lot of the sort of domestic policies, such as control orders that have been brought in the UK, are specifically aimed at young Muslim men. And that's kind of creating a sort of resentment and marginalisation of that part of the population. Which is a dangerous thing, whether it is indeed aimed at them or not.
You're not saying, are you, that it isn't vital to combat terrorism?
No. I mean, obviously, terrorism is an important security issue. We're not denying that in the slightest. But what we are saying is that the current approaches simply just aren't working. So we would really suggest a kind of two-pronged approach to dealing with terrorism, really trying to really understand properly what it is that is causing people to be attracted to the al-Qaeda-type ideology. And the second would be really a kind of more traditional counter-terrorism approach, but addressing terrorism as an issue of policing and criminality rather than as a military issue. So we're talking about things like targeting international funding networks. And it's these kind of very almost unsexy, if you like, very hard, detailed, investigative analysis that will really do much more to kind of defeat terrorism than any military or war on terror ever could.
What can we do in terms of, apart from the what you might call police action? Mm-hmm. Because al-Qaeda, they don't want to sit down and negotiate, do they? Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to distinguish really between sort of two areas. One is the kind of, if you might call the leadership, the kind of ideological leadership of groups and movements like al-Qaeda. And then really the second part is the kind of loose network of affiliated groups and individuals around the world who have been attracted to this kind of ideology. And we're really, I suppose, talking about the second group primarily. The first group has been there for a long time. The sort of this kind of ideology and leadership has been around for several decades. But it's the second group of people, as I said, loose affiliated groups around the world and individuals who are angry at what they perceive as an attack on Islam. And movements like Al-Qaeda suggest to them a kind of violent course of action.
So it's targeting the recruitment, effectively.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call it recruitment as such.
Well, kind of the people that they might have come towards them, if you give them fewer reasons to be angry.
Exactly, yeah, that's one of the things. And also, I mean, we are seeing, if you like, an element of kind of self-radicalisation, whereby, you know, groups of young men in particular are sat around the internet watching videos from Iraq in their home. And these are small groups of friends who aren't known to the police, aren't known to the security services. And these, as you were, I think, are the people that the police and security services are really concerned about. But in order to combat that, some of our very strict domestic counterterrorism policies are actually, if you like, increasing the radicalisation of these people as they see themselves under attack.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Chris Abbott, who's a program coordinator and researcher at the Oxford Research Group, which is an independent global security think tank based in the UK. And we're talking about his book, or he's a co-author of the book, Beyond Terror, The Truth About the Real Threats to Our World. What are the threats, then, that are actually more significant than terrorism? Let's take them one by one, because global warming is the first thing you talk about.
Yeah, I mean, what we've tried to do in the book is really look at the kind of wide-ranging various threats to security, and security in the broadest sense. And we've looked at not just those that are likely to lead to loss of life, but also really could cause instability at the global level. And the first and perhaps one of the most important of those is climate change, which really, even just the last year or two, has become a really hot political issue. The debate over whether climate change is real or not real is really over. We know the science behind climate change now. We know what's causing it, and we have a fairly good idea about some of the effects and what they're likely to be. What we're trying to assess in the book is what the security implications of that are.
And really, what are they? I mean, obviously, there's worst-case scenarios and there's best-case scenarios, but what are the things that we might have to deal with over the next, I don't know, 4 or 5 decades?
Well, if you look at some of the conservative kind of science behind it, I mean, we are going to be looking at a rise in global temperatures, we are going to be looking at a rise in sea levels, and we are going to be looking at a rise in extreme weather events. There's debate over kind of how much and to what extent, but we know those things will happen. So from that, we can say that there will be obvious socioeconomic impacts. We're going to see a loss of infrastructure, we're going to see a mass displacement of peoples, and we're going to see resource scarcity. Now, those are where the security implications begin to come in. And we are likely, and it's only likely, to be able to see a rise in civil unrest, both as people try and resist some of the measures that are likely to be necessary, and also at the same time, whilst people try to push government to do more. I mean, we may even see a rise of sort of extremist environmental movements. And that's really kind of at the national level. We're also likely to see intercommunal conflict developing over access to key resources.
Access to water.
Exactly.
And water, access to land that's not going to be flooded.
Exactly. This is it. We can expect to see that really happening. But perhaps what we're more concerned about is at the international level, whereby climate change is really likely to lead to new geopolitical challenges that we're concerned that our current system just isn't set up to deal with. So we're talking about changing coastlines. As coastlines change, so do countries' maritime boundaries and exclusive economic rights to that area change.
Oh, it's a dog's breakfast, isn't it?
Exactly. So, but you've really got to start picking these things apart, because once you can kind of get down and understand what it is that these security concerns are where they're coming from, and what it is the likely effects of these things, you can then start to put in preventative strategies. And the preventative that goes beyond reducing carbon emissions in order to prevent climate change, which is hugely important. But at each stage, from environmental to socioeconomic to security effects, we also need to put in preventative strategies there.
You're not Robinson Crusoe on this. It must be, 3 years ago that the Pentagon came out and said that actually climate change was the single biggest threat to American national security. An announcement that must have caused some embarrassment, actually, to the Bush government at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually the Office of Net Assessment at the Pentagon, which is a kind of Pentagon think tank, if you like, and it was an independently commissioned report from them. And they were looking specifically at catastrophic climate change, so very abrupt, very severe, extreme climate change. And the scenarios that they looked at were really at the sort of edges of possibility, if you like. So while that was an extremely important report, and it did a lot to kind of raise awareness, perhaps more since rather than at the time, because it was looking at such an extreme scenario, the Bush administration, if you like, could kind of ignore it to a certain extent.
Well, we've talked about climate change is the biggie, and it's a real threat to our world as you see it. In fact, there are others as well. It's a daunting list. Mm-hmm. How do we respond? How do we change the agenda and change the priorities?
Well, really, we need to rethink the way governments go about doing international security. Now, that's a big ask. And if you go beyond that, I mean, fundamentally, if we're really going to get serious, we need to reform our whole systems of trade, aid and debt relief, and really start to move away from carbon-based economies. Now, that, as I said, is a big ask. And the first thing is really to try and get governments to rethink how we do security. It shouldn't be about achieving our security through any means necessary, as it were, because often that comes at the expense of other people's security. Mm. We talk in the book about the control paradigm, which is how we describe current approaches. And it's really about trying to kind of maintain the status quo through military force. What we're trying to do is promote a different way of looking at security, if you like. And really, that brings in preventative rather than reactive strategies. And it's based on resolving the root causes of conflict. And that is the things we talk about in the book, climate change, competition over resources, et cetera.
It's timely, isn't it? I mean, there's an election in Australia now. There's the US over the next 12 months, mm-hmm. 18 months or so until the next one in the UK.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I mean, towards the end of the book, we talk about the fact that perhaps a change in leadership is what's needed and may actually bring about some of this change in thinking. I mean, we are finding that we're being politicians are much more receptive to this thinking now than perhaps they once were. The kind of notion and understanding of the more non-traditional threats to our security, the kind of non-defence, as if you like, threats, has really rapidly increased since 9/11, which was, I think, a big wake-up call that the kind of Cold War style of thinking about defence and security was at jeopardy.
Well, hopefully your book will be read by the right people. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Chris Abbott's program coordinator of the Oxford Research Group, a British think tank specialising in global security. And just confusingly, it's not anymore in Oxford, it's actually in London these days. Next week, he'll be addressing an Australian Federal Police conference about his ideas on real threats. His book's called Beyond Terror, The Truth About Real Threats to Our World, and it's published by Random House. Next on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, a double debut for our musical Meet the Listener.
There's a photo I remember well, I'm naked to the waist, squeezing lemons off the tree, the hair across my face. At night we swam the dark white sea in phosphorescent gleam. The music rolled off ancient hills, oh, that's the way it seemed. Words they told of magic, of the seasons, work and love, the heaven we could build on earth if we struggled hard enough. From all by their ability and for their needs to each, the struggle was back then as now to practice what we preach. And sometimes I fear I'm standing here with nothing to tell, but when the music's flowing, it's like water from the well, drawing water from the well. Why I turned aside, I'll give you 15 answers and tell you 20 lies. banter. You have to lean into the bend. That's one thing I have learned. I've lived a life of changes. I've followed many trains. The siren call of freedom, the loneliness it entails. I've shot my arrows in the air like any archer born. I've drained the cup of sadness and I've played the hand of joy. And sometimes I fear I'm standing here with nothing to tell. But when the music's flowing, it's like water from the well, drawing water from the well.
Well, this track is called Water from the Well, and it's from Tony Eardley's debut album, Desire Lines. Tony's today's Meet the Listener guest, but the album's not the only debut in Tony's life at this time, because on exactly the same day, there was another delivery that's brought about, well, I guess an even bigger change in the life of the 57-year-old. Welcome to Life Matters, Tony.
Good morning, Richard. Thanks.
Now, what happened that day?
Well, my daughter Matilda was born on the same day. We were walking around the corridor of the hospital trying to sort of bring on...
Get things started.
Labor, yeah. Yes. And I got the call on my mobile to say that the CD had been delivered from the manufacturer. So it was within an hour of the birth.
Mixed emotions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was amazing to have it both happen at the same time. It had been a sort of neck-and-neck race as to who was going to come... Which of the babies was going to come first, really?
Right, OK, so I know the name of the album's Desire Lines. What about the name of your daughter?
Matilda.
Right, and she's how old?
4 months old now.
And the sleeping?
Not too bad, not too bad. It's it gets a bit interrupted at times, and she suddenly decided just recently to start waking up more frequently again, but on the whole, it's OK.
So at 57, when many men are thinking about a quieter life... You've got it all going on.
Yes, I know. It's crazy, really. Yes, she's my first biological daughter, so I left it rather late in life. But, yeah, there's a lot happening. And my partner already has
four children. You're involved in quite a tribe, aren't you?
That's right. There's now 5 children altogether.
Yeah. Rocky. How are you finding the experience of juggling work and music and parenting?
Well, it's you have to sort of reinvent it every day. Really, it's hard. There's no doubt that it's difficult, and there are times when it's particularly hard. But you just have to sort of treat every day as having this whole series of tasks that you have to get through and try and get them all done in the different spheres of life. You know? And
I'd imagine the music's the one that's copping it at the moment.
Yeah, it is kind of, except that because I've got these CD launches coming up, it's meant I've had to focus a fair bit just recently on actually making that happen. So I suppose in some ways it's the work which is being squeezed a wee bit at the moment, because I'm only working part-time, but it's hard to keep it.
What is the day job, Tony?
Well, I'm a social researcher. I work at the Social Policy Research Centre at New South Wales Uni, and I've gone down from being full-time to being part-time since my daughter was born, but it's quite hard actually making a transition from being full-time to part-time. It's the kind of job in a way that's just never really contained by hours anyway. So it's, yeah, that's a tricky one.
I'll bet. Okay, well, let's talk a bit more about the music. Desire Lines is your first solo CD.
It is.
Did you come to music late in life too, or is this something...
Well, I used to do it quite a bit a long time ago, back in my early 20s, back in the UK. But I really just gave up for around, I don't know, 25 years or more.
Why?
Well, it's hard to say. And in some ways, that song you just played, Water from the Well, is really about that. It's sort of exploring you know, what happened and why. I think for some reason, I don't know, it was just, I wasn't sure it was going anywhere much for me at the time, and there were lots of other things happening in my life, and it just sort of drifted away somehow. It was hard to keep hold of it. I stopped, and then it was really sort of by accident, moving to Australia in the mid-90s. I kind of met up with people again in the music world, in the folk scene over here, and I heard people singing and thinking, oh yeah, I used to do that. Maybe I should have another go. And so I started playing again, got myself another guitar, and just started playing around the sessions and folk clubs and things a bit, and people kept saying, oh yeah, that's good, you should do more, you should record, you know? And I actually joined a songwriting group. A few of my friends actually formed a songwriting group, which was really great. It was a really good way of actually writing songs again and getting feedback and getting a feeling of where you're going with it, you know?
Was it brutal?
It wasn't too brutal. People were supportive. I mean, they're critical, you know, but in a supportive way. And we sort of trusted each other's views quite well because we knew each other quite well. You know,
that's good.
So that helped. Quite a few of the songs on the album sort of came out of that process.
You've written most of them. I know there's Nick Drake track, one of my favourite songs, actually, Northern Skies.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've written most of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
There's one on it, on Days Like This.
Yes. Well, there's quite a story attached to that, really. It's about when I was hitchhiking through Italy back when I was about 21, and I met a young Italian woman, a student, and we had a romantic interlude for a day by a lake in the north of Italy, and then we had to go on in our separate ways, but we planned to meet up again, and, you know, who knows what might have happened, but in Venice, about a week later, I lost my address book, which had all her contact details, and I was never able to get hold of her again. And I actually got a postcard from her back in England a few weeks later, just sort of, you know, saying, you know, remember me? She hadn't heard from me, you know.
But no
return address. I even tried through some friends in Bologna, where she came from, to see if they could sort of find out about her. But I didn't know anything about her, really, other than her first name. I couldn't even remember what her second name was properly. You know, you're 21. You don't take that kind of thing in, really.
You're focused on other things.
That's right, yeah. And so I have no idea what's happened to her. But for some reason, this all just came up one day on a misty afternoon in the mountains when I was playing around on the guitar, and
there it is.
And the song emerged from that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, you're also part of another group that we love here at Life Matters, the Spooky Men's Chorale.
Yes.
Who also have a new album out, and you describe yourself as genial buffoonery and immaculate testosterone-drenched vocals. I don't know who wrote this. A ruthless bunch of larrikins whose stated ambition is to make women cry, small children quail, and insurance salesmen vaguely aware that somewhere there's a whole world they've never experienced.
Yeah, that just about sums it up, yeah.
That must be a lot of fun, the Spooky Men's.
It's a lot of fun, yeah. Yes, it's really good doing stuff with a bunch of other blokes in a somewhat different way from how blokes often interact with each other, and it's great. It's really good fun.
I know you've got your album launch coming up this election weekend. Where can we hear you?
I'm playing on election night itself, actually, at the Clarendon in Katoomba.
This is if you're in the area, in the Blue Mountains or possibly in Sydney.
That's right. And then on the following night, I'm playing on the Sunday, 25th, I'm playing at the Harp in Tempe.
In Tempe, that's on the Prince's Highway,
that's
sort
right.
of the inner south of Sydney.
Yeah, and I'll have a full band with me, both of those gigs. So,
well... good luck with it all. Good luck with everything, Tony. And thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks a lot, Richard.
That was singer, songwriter, new dad and spooky man, Tony Eardley. And we'll put a link to his website on the Life Matters website. That's at abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. Coming up after the news on ABC Radio National, it's The Book Show with Ramona Koval. And Ramona is here now.
And, Richard, it's going to be wall-to-wall music because you did a bit of music just then, and we're going to be speaking with writer Amit Chowdhury, who's known to The Book Show as an author and a novelist and poet, but he's going to be speaking to me about his music, his latest CD called This Is Not Fusion.
Oh, right. OK. I did not know that Amit Chowdhury was a musician as well.
All will be revealed.
It's living and learning. on the book show after the news, which is coming up very shortly on ABC Radio National. Now, tomorrow on Life Matters, a new take on the Oedipus myth. Yes, there really is a new one after thousands of years. And we'll also have more Polly spottings. You've been very active due to my encouragement. I'll see you tomorrow. Ramona's next.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.